Hey, it's Francis. This week, we're going back in time to last year. Look, I know no one wants to go back to last year, but in this case, it's okay, because even during the height of the pandemic, we could still go outside, get the grill fired up, and have a taste, hopefully a great taste, of normalcy. And that's what we hope this episode did, and if you missed it the first time, you'll still be in for some killer grilling ideas. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Okay, so let me be honest with you for a second. I'm a pretty good cook. I'll go ahead and say that. But I am just a passable griller. I mean, I think I have an excuse. I grew up in a family that, you know, believed in air conditioning as one of the signs that you really made it in life, so we never went outside. And now I live in a small apartment in New York, and I'm just not sure my insurance policy covers, like, kicking over the hibachi and, like, spewing the coals into someone's yard. But my friends, who I'm staying with in my quarantine house, do have a grill out here. And I get it. It is fun. But, you know, I did some chicken thighs a few weeks ago. I stepped back into the kitchen to get a couple things. And I turned around to see smoke billowing out of the grill. And I opened the cover and the chicken is just engulfed in flames. And you know what happened after that? I spent the next 2 weeks obsessing over when I could get back to the store, get some more chicken, and get another shot at it. I just kept imagining what I would do and how I would oil the grates and how I would crisp them here and move them there. There is something so satisfying about really working a grill. It's obsession-inducing, and obviously that is not news to many people. But I suppose a lot of folks are going to be feeling that thrill this weekend. So this week on the show, we've got three absolute masters of grilling to give us tips and ideas and inspiration for what we could be cooking. My dear friend and author of many grilling books, Doc Willoughby, will be taking your calls with me. The phenomenal North Carolina chef Ashley Christensen will join us to talk about just super rad things she does with vegetables on the grill. But first, we're going to go to St. Paul, Minnesota, and we're going to talk to Chef Yia Vang of Union Hmong Kitchen. The Hmong, if you're not familiar with them, are an ethnic group without their own country. Their communities live mostly in China, Vietnam, Laos, and Thailand. They live up in the mountains usually, and they're a super proud community. The anthropologist James Scott once wrote about them in this amazingly titled book, The Art of Not Being Governed. But many Hmong soldiers were recruited to fight for the U.S. during the Laotian Civil War, and after that war, Hmong refugees began coming to America, with many of them settling in St. Paul. Chef Yia Vang came to America as a child. He grew up in Minnesota, and now is one of the country's leading voices in Hmong cooking, which revolves around the grill. Hey, Chef. It's great to talk with you.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So, you grew up in the Twin Cities, which has the biggest Hmong community in the country, but you weren't born there. Can you first start by telling us how your family came to the States?
Yeah, so my parents ended up in a refugee camp in Thailand called Vinai. My mom and dad met there in 77, and then they got married in 78, and then I was born in 84, so, and then we left in 88. So when we first left, to be able to come to America, you need like a sponsor. So, so we had some sponsors and we were able to, I think we landed in St. Paul. That was kind of the first place we landed.
Yeah. Do you remember, I mean, so you were like 4 or 5 years old. Do you remember landing? Like, do you remember your first impressions?
Yeah. Like, it's super weird. So it's like one of those things where it's like, when you like have a dream and you can't really remember if it was a dream or if it was real, that's how feel with all my memories from, you know, those when I was younger. So I remember going, my parents, we were going through this big building and you had to sit and there's all these people and you had to do all this paperwork. And then we went into this long hallway. It was a big metal hallway, which was the terminal. And then we ended up sitting in these metal chairs and they put these seatbelts on us and, you know, and then everything started shaking and there's these nice ladies that came by and they had this uniform. And then I remember the first time they gave me this little red can And my mom and dad was like, oh yeah, you can drink that. And that was the first time my lips touched Coca-Cola. And when that sweet, you know, like that sweet high fructose corn syrup hit my lip, I knew that was American freedom. That's where I was just like, what is this? And I was like, this is the most delicious thing ever. And then, I remember getting off, walking through another big terminal, and my mom kept saying, we're in America. And I was like, oh, to get to America, you just sit in this chair and it shakes, you fall asleep, you wake up, and then they give you a really nice sugar drink. That's my way of trying to get some, you know, some corporate sponsors from Coke. So.
So this was, like you said, in the late 80s. Yeah. What was... Do you recall like what the Hmong community was like at the time? Like I, you know, we started this by saying the Hmong community in Twin Cities is the biggest in the country. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it was much smaller at that time.
Yeah. I mean, it was the big wave that was coming in. Like today, you know, you have a lot of a lot of Syrian refugees, Middle Eastern refugees, West Africans, you know, that are coming in to the Twin Cities here. At that time, the wave was a lot of Southeast Asian refugees. So the, mm-hmm. the Hmong people were the biggest. So it was just, you know, like every other week it was, oh yeah, so-and-so's uncle's here, like their family's here, you know? And mm-hmm. so it was just wave after wave of new refugees and immigrants.
Yeah. How'd you learn to cook?
Cooking for me came from watching my mom and dad. Here's the I can give you this really romantic story, but here's the actual truth. When we were kids, there was the rule in the house. If you help cook, you don't have to do the dishes, and I hated doing dishes. So I'm like, if I get in the kitchen when my dad or my mom's cooking and I help slice something or I help cut something, I'm technically cooking. So then I don't have to do dishes at the end. And so that's the real reason, but I can give you this super romantic, you know, like, oh, we sat around and rice is flying everywhere. No,
we're here for real talk, man.
Yeah. So we're here for real talk. Like, I was like, dude, I don't have new dishes. So here's the other thing too, Francis, you got to realize, and I in a lot of Southeast Asian communities and our families, and especially in Hmong families, our homes, we had dishwashers, but we never used them. Dishwashers was like a glorified drying rack. Like my parents never believed that a dishwasher could actually do what it's meant to do. So they believed in the good hard work of using your hands. And when your kids are like 5, 6 years old, like it's like you get on the step stool, you get up there and you use that elbow grease and you know, you wash dishes. And I hated doing it. So my parents were like, yeah, like if you cook in the kitchen, you don't have to do dishes. I'm like, sign me up.
Oh my God. Yeah. That is the most immigrant thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
Man,
it's like, we just need to work.
Yeah.
Things cannot be easy. We just need to work.
Yeah. Like we had a dishwasher growing up. I never knew that was a dishwasher. No joke, bro. I always thought that it was just, you know, a rack where we put all their dishes after we got done washing. And then I went to my white friend's house and I realized I'm like, I felt like my world was coming crashing down. I'm like, you told me that we had this the whole time, but we're just using it to put clean dishes in there. Blew my mind.
Man, that's how you got your work ethic, man.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean, you talk to any of the Hmong kids, they have all these stories. Like growing up, it was, you know, we didn't go to the grocery stores and get our meats there. Like we would go, you know, to a lot of the farmers and then, you know, kind of haggle a deal. And then it'd be like, oh, yep, like we have these pigs here. You can, you know, we kind of just buy them like fresh from the farm in a way. And mm-hmm. so on the weekends, in the mornings, while kids were off playing t-ball and doing basketball camps, Hmong kids were like put into cars and we went out to the farms and that's what we did. It was like they, you know, they killed the pig and then you just kind of gather around and everyone starts cutting. And then for me, my father, you know, at a young age, just gave me a boning knife and just showed me where all the tendons were and how to make all the primal cuts. And so I was more comfortable holding a boning knife than holding a baseball growing up. And I, you know, it was just, it was rhythm. It was, you know, it's like, oh, here's all these chickens. You know, we have 50 chickens and you're going to have to pluck them and you're going to have to, you know, do all these things. And
yeah.
For me, that was just normal. And
yeah. But let's talk about what you're going to do with that meat after you cut it up. Like what the importance of grilling in Hmong food. So I don't know Hmong food very mm-hmm. well, but so, I know grilling is really central to it. Tell us about
definitely.
That.
So for us and for me, it was, you know, I worked at all these different restaurants, you know, a lot of, you know, when you, every cook, when you start out, when you have some kind of cooking job, you always start out some kind of Italian, American Italian restaurant. So that's kind of where I got my start, you know, and then I started working in like these smokehouse grill places and end up working at some of these like French, you know, style restaurant. And so it's, you know, a lot of those very Eurocentric restaurant, a lot of your proteins is, you know, it's braised, cooked in a pan, saute, you know. And so that's really, you know, that's a legit way of cooking. But like one of the things that we did that I really love is, for example, so we're at this point where we get, you know, you bring the pig in, everyone cuts it up. And then, you know, my dad would just start a fire in our fireplace. You know, the house we lived in had a fire pit, you know. And when I say fire pit, like growing up, a lot of my friends would be like, oh, come over for a bonfire. And I'm like, cool. Because in my mind, when you think of bonfire, you're grilling meats on top of it. But it'd be like, we get over there. It's like, these are my white friend's house. We get over there and then they just like have a fire and everyone just like stares into it. And I'm like, wait, where's the meat? Like, why aren't we grilling meat right now? Like,
what's
the point of a fire if we're not grilling meat? And then they come out with marshmallows. I'm like, what are you guys doing? You know, I remember as a kid, I'm like, this is the dumbest thing ever, man. So my dad would get the fire started and he would jimmy rig some kind of grill on top. And, you know, and then he'll start showing us how to break it down to like certain kind of cuts. And then we just quickly throw in some kind of marinade, some kind of sauce. And then we just throw it on the grill. And that's just how Hmong people have been doing it for years and years. And, you know, passed down, like, you know, if you go into the hills of Laos, I mean, what it is they start a fire and then they put these like basically kind of these bamboo sticks on top as kind of the racks. And then you just lay the meat on top. And it's almost like a slow and low kind of drying the meat / you know, like a hard grill on it. You know, it's like, you know, they get it hot. So you do a hard grill and then you hang it up higher and it just kind of lets that smoke as the fat drips down. And this is pork. That smoke just hits that, you know, that meat. And so, and then the way you marinate it or the way that you sauce it up is it's a lot of like fish sauce, chili peppers, garlic, ginger. It's very high in umami flavor. And the reason is because the meat is so scarce that you really are trying just to get a flavor out of it, you know? So you're trying to get that fat, you're trying to get that flavor.
So you can eat a lot of other things to go with
rice. Yeah. Yep. Rice and veggies. Yes, yes, yes.
That's Ye Vang, chef and founder of Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis, and we'll be back with more conversation with him in a minute. And then we're going to get some killer grilled vegetable ideas from Chef Ashley Christensen. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table. We're talking with Ye Vang, founder of Union Hmong Kitchen in St. Paul, and after hearing how he came to America from a refugee camp in Thailand, we got into some grilling methods inspired by Hmong tradition. So you mentioned, a simple marinade might have fish sauce, chilies. Like, what would be like a ratio you would use?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I'm sure there are 1,000 styles, but what would be like a good in your head kind of ratio?
Yep. So what I've told people is that it's up to you. So for example, some people really love it. Like for example, I say shallots, garlic, ginger, lemongrass, and Thai chilies. Then you have the option of fish sauce and oyster sauce and salt and pepper. Right there, that's your base. Right there, that's kind of your mirepoix. That's your, I just say it's like our sofrito.
And kind of like, is there like more of this, less of that, or truly like whatever you want?
It's truly whatever you want. If you want it more garlicky, you go maybe 3 parts garlic, 2 parts ginger, 1 part lemongrass. If you want it more lemongrass, more floral, you go 3 parts lemongrass, 2 part ginger, 1 part garlic. You know, if you want it more gingery, again, 3, 2, 1.
Okay.
You know, and then, you know, from there on, it's oyster sauce, Thai chilies, whatever spice you want it or whatever heat you want it to be. 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, and then my parents don't do this, but I always love that kind of that round, almost molassy flavor of oyster sauce. So I dabble that in on, and then literally you take that, that mix goes really, really well with pork, or you can do steak. Chicken is just so subtle that like chicken, if it absorbs all that flavor, it just kind of overpowers chicken. and then get your coals nice and, you know, you get them hot so they're all gray, have them break down, and then just put it over that coal. And then don't be afraid to just keep flipping it. And you want, and apparently, you know, for me, it's like you want that char. So I usually have that heat pretty high at the end. You know, at the end, add more coals, and then you get that char. And then once you do, you pull it off, slice it real thin, get some sticky rice, get some hot sauce. And then, you know, it's great food to be accompanied with, like, some highballs, some good cocktails, like a light beer, a lager, you know. And, yeah, it's just, it's great summer food.
Right on. Do you marinate the pork for a long time, or is it, like, kind of slap it on and go?
Yeah, it's totally up to you. How you want to do that. Like, you know, if you think of it the night before, you could totally just throw all that together, marinate the meat and for the night before. If you have a couple hours out, definitely. The easiest thing I do, if I have a couple hours out, I make all that. You put it in, like a food processor, all those ingredients, and just chop it up till it's real, you know, fine or, you know, small bits. You throw it into the meat and then put it in a Ziploc bag and try to squeeze all the air out of it and let it sit in a Ziploc bag for a couple hours. And then what I do is I actually take all that excess marinade that's in that bag. I get a bowl and then you get a little bit of water and a little bit of vinegar and a little bit of oil and you mix it into that bowl. And while you're grilling, you kind of baste that on there.
And right on.
Yep. And all those sugars in there will help caramelize that and we'll get that real nice crisp. There's a really beautiful char on top. And again, it takes time. Like that's why, you know, I think people are so used to like, that's why, you know, people use propane grills. Like I get it because it's convenient, but that's why I love using charcoal grill because it takes time. It's for me, it's this thing that, you know, my father, you know, he taught me how to do this. And as a Hmong kid growing up, all the men would be in the back and they would be grilling. And if you stand close enough to them, And they allow you to. They'll kind of give you one of the tongs, and you can help, you know, flip some of the meats, you know. And that for me at age like 11 or 12, like I got to do that, and I just fell in love with it. And just hearing all these, you know, like all my cousins, my uncles, my, you know, my dad, and all, just hearing them talk. And then that's where a lot of the older generation would kind of talk about, you know, the days of old. They would talk about, you know, Laos. They would talk about the war, and they would tell stories. And it was just super cool to, as a kid, to sit. You know, it's kind of sit by them and listen to those stories while they're grilling meats. And for me today, even like when I'm doing that, you know, for the restaurant, if I'm doing that for a party, like it brings up all that memory. It, for me, that's why I love doing it, you know, and it's harder. And grilling over wood is a lot harder. It's more expensive. It's harder. It takes more time. But I just love it.
Yeah. It's that feeling. That feeling matters. Thanks so much, Chef.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
Ye Vang is chef and founder of Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis. You can find a recipe for his essential meat marinade at splendidtable.org. Our next guest is the chef Ashley Christensen from Raleigh, North Carolina. And here is my favorite Ashley Christensen story. So she is really one of the best chefs in the South. And the day I learned that was the day she cooked a 12-course lunch for the Southern Foodways Alliance Fall Symposium. I think it was back in 2012. Anyway, the theme of the conference was barbecue. So everyone filed in expecting, you know, a killer meat fest. And out the food comes. I remember I was sitting across from the chef, Sean Brock, and we were eating first the peas and then the greens and then the tomato pie, and everything was so ridiculously delicious. And we kept eating, and all of a sudden it was like 300 people in the room all looked up and realized at the same exact moment that here she was serving us an entirely vegetarian meal at a barbecue conference. And it was probably the best meal any of us had eaten that year. So Ashley is an absolute mic-dropping master of vegetables. And so I wanted to check in with her to see what she's been grilling this summer. Hey, Ash, it's great to talk with you.
Hi, Francis. Great to talk with you.
Yeah, so you said the first... I want to start by saying this, because when we were chatting yesterday to get ready, you said the most amazing thing. You said that you... you said that you have a grill problem, meaning that you actually collect grills. Like, you love grilling that much that you collect different grills, and you now have a rule in your home where you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to bring home another grill unless you get one out.
Yes, my amazing, smart, beautiful, thoughtful, very funny wife has decided that, you know, she leads with positivity and saying, you can bring another one home, but if you do, one's got to go. So we have a one in, one out grill rule.
All right. So aside from your very well stocked supply of grills, I knew you were someone we'd want to talk to for our grilling show this year, because when we were talking about it, I remember this time that I called you up for an article, like, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And we were talking about grilling vegetables, and you totally blew my mind. I don't know if you remember this, but you just said, oh, I've been getting into grilling zucchini or summer squash without oil, without seasoning, just like throwing it right on there until you get a nice char on the outside. And then when you take it off the grill and you cut it up, that's when you season it and oil it, because I remember, I'll never forget this explanation. You're like, oh, as things get hot, they expand and the steam comes out. And as they cool, they have to like suck back in. So that's how you suck in all that seasoning. And that's how you get, you know, that's one way to get great flavor in your vegetables. And I have been doing that on the grill. I've been doing that in the oven. Like, it totally changed the way I deal with. Ashley, you changed the way I deal with zucchini.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up, you know, and there are a couple of things that I love in cooking. There are a lot of things I love in cooking, but first is just the science of what makes things do the things they do, you know, and I think that's, I love talking about that because I think it helps people really understand as they think about how they want to approach food and cooking. And so just what you just referenced is the idea that we know that, like, the reason that we cure salmon with salt is because it pulls the moisture out of it as a means of preservation. Well, if we put salt also on a vegetable, it's going to naturally pull the moisture out of that as well and draw liquid to the surface that when we go and try and get a good sear, we sort of erase some of the possibility of that. So, you know, just letting the vegetable be what it is and interact with the fire and then the oil. I often think about that when you see, you know, folks like lighting a pan on fire to show that they're cooking, you know, something. And, you know, a pan should only ever be on fire if there's alcohol in it. And otherwise otherwise we're burning oil, you know, and it's a very familiar taste that it can be very disappointing. But when we think about the fire, you know, the fire doesn't need oil to have a relationship with the vegetables or whatever you're cooking. So, yeah, just little simple details like that, you know, we encounter and they begin to really, you know, start to speak to all the ways we think about food.
Yeah. You also mentioned something yesterday that I really want you to get into, a super cool thing you do with potatoes on the grill. Cause that's not something that people really think about very much.
So, you know, I think, especially in times like this, when we're thinking about making our budgets go as far as they can and our pantries go as far as they can, if I'm making beautiful coals to cook over, I don't want to just cook one thing, you know, so that when I'm burning charcoal or burning wood, I'm making sense of the fuel that I'm using. And so I used to do something where we would like take potatoes and wrap them in foil and bury them in coals. And it's really hard to like really get that right because, you know, the varying amounts of sugar that are in a cellared potato or a new potato. And, you know, sometimes it's like you took what you had and you threw it in the coals and you just made more charcoal. So I just started thinking about this and how, you know, if you cut potatoes and you cook them and you overcook them, you kind of ruin them and they become really starchy. But if you never break the skin and you boil them in water that I like to describe as salty like the sea, which I always just, when people go like, what do you mean by that? And I'm like, think about the first time you got in the ocean and got completely pummeled by a wave and the way your mouth tasted, that's the amount of salt. So that's how we season that water. And we boil potatoes with their skin intact and just to the point that they are so tender that you could almost set a fork on top of them and the fork would just naturally go in. So that's like really cooked. And then I let them sit and kind of come to room temperature, and I cook whatever else I'm cooking, whether it be vegetables or a flank steak or, you know, a spatchcock chicken, or, you know, then at the sort of close of whatever my main thing is that I'm cooking, I then bring those beautiful potatoes out and get them as close as I can to those coals and let the skins just really crust up and blister. And you end up with this really beautiful flavor of, you know, the coals speaking to that paper thin layer of potato skin. And then on the inside, it's just like sweet, creamy butter, and they don't even really need anything else added to them. And I think, when, again, to the currency of the pantry, you know, I think that I love, you know, I'm not going to cook 4 potatoes. I'm going to cook 12 and have them in a Ziploc. And then I'm going to, the next day, get up and take those potatoes and crumble them and drizzle vinaigrette over them and cut a tomato next to them or slice an avocado, whatever it might be. And then even 2 days after that, I may crumble that up and throw it in something I'm sauteing with some of the other leftover stuff that spoke to the grill a couple nights before.
Right on. What are some other things that you're into that other people may not think to put on the grill?
You know, my mom always made zucchini bread when I was a kid, because the thing we could never keep up with in the garden was how fast the zucchini grew. Now, when we end up at the market and buying a bunch of the overgrown squash from our great farmers, we take that and we cut it, you know, from pole to pole, and sear that cut flesh side and sear the outside. And I really love cooking a rich vegetable like zucchini to the point where when you taste the center of it, it tastes the temperature that things taste when you pull them out of the garden. And I was very lucky to grow up in a home where our most important chores were done in the garden. And, you know, my father was far ahead of the little community we lived in. He was the guy collecting bugs in the yard and pureeing them in the blender that was dedicated to the potting bench to make organic pesticide. And my friends were like, "What is he doing now?"
But, Ash, what's up with your dad?
What's up with your dad, yo?
Blender.
But I think knowing what it feels like to eat a vegetable, you know, right from the earth and of its seasons. Temperature is a very special thing. And so I always notice when, you know, I really love room temperature things, you know, and I think that's what I think about when we char that squash and create like this fresh, you know, kind of, just marinated salad. I think about the way that zucchini smells when you break it off of that kind of prickly plant from which it grows. So, yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things that's so special about the grill is that you can do all of this work with the live coals and then just experience things at room temperature where they feel like someone just cooked them for you and handed them to you right off the grill. But you get to really taste the notes of, you know, everything that makes that vegetable what it is, and all of the unique and distinct textures that, that define that specific experience.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because I think you talk so much about like memory and there's so much like sense of expectation, and how do you connect to those senses in something as simple as a grilled zucchini or a grilled vegetable. But then there are ways where, you know, things get really upended, right? So you talked about a really unexpected thing, which is your love of grilled cucumber.
Yeah. And that's something that my friend and your friend, Sean Brock, came and cooked with me a long time ago. And we get together and generally when we get to spend time together, we're cooking for, some cause that we mutually love and believe in. And at some point I can't remember what the dish was, but he wanted to grill these cucumbers, and that had never crossed my mind. I just have always thought of that as like that fresh, crispy vegetable or the vegetable that you pickle.
Right.
Again, one of my favorite parts about cooking is like just having your ideas sort of turned upside down. But it's quite similar to that zucchini idea, that, you know, the idea of getting this caramelization on the outside of the cucumber, that creates an experience that is very different from what it tastes like raw, but still getting to have that crunchy, really fruity green center to it. And I just love that. The greatest way to experience a vegetable is often just raw and simple and as it is, but it almost feels even more respectful to the vegetable to be able to, recognize its potential when it meets heat and still have it be centered and balanced by its crunchy center that is exactly intact as it was. So
how would you do that? You would put it over a really hot grill?
Yeah.
Just try the outside and take it off pretty quick?
Yeah, I think that's, a place where, look, a cucumber, when we even say the word, and I can picture cutting into it and the water that, comes to the surface of a slice of fresh cucumber, and that is some of the most delicious water, right? And the idea, I think, is for things to be very hot because of that amount of water. You want to create that caramelization very quickly. You don't want it like slow cooking and like when we're cooking a steak, well, a steak goes from rare to well done because the juices within that steak begin to simmer inside of that steak and move around, and that hot liquid begins to cook the protein. So, in a vegetable, it's very similar. You're taking that thing, if you're cooking it slow, you're letting it kind of simmer and stew. And when I say stew, you picture the texture that you will ultimately end up with if that's our approach. But if we sear something, then we quickly caramelize the outside of it. And my goal is generally for the center of it to really be what it was when we started, and with something like a cucumber, for it to really be crunchy and bright, and the outside to tell a new story of the relationship of that source of heat. Again, I've been talking a lot about grilling lately. I've been spending a lot of time in front of my grill, and it feels good to cook outside right now. It feels good to cook right now.
Yeah.
But for sure. But also, I it's important that people have, there are a lot of people living in apartment buildings who do not have, the privilege of stepping into a backyard or a courtyard and doing that. So the cast iron, I think, is just a really lovely substitution for that. And as I often talk about with Poole's Diner, we don't have a grill there because it's a little kitchen. And early on, I just thought, if I can't have a wood fire grill, then I don't really want a grill there. And we sort of stuck to that. But we work the heck out of cast iron pans at Poole's Diner. And I think we often, though not with the same spirit of the coals, and that same flavor and that same conversation, that's not present, but we are able to really create that incredible caramelization and quick sear and intense heat that is the promise of the cast iron pan.
Right on. All right, so let's quick sear our way through the summer. Thanks so much for taking the time, Ash. I know you're super busy right now, but it's great to talk with you.
It's wonderful to hear your voice, and thanks for having me here today.
Ashley Christensen is the chef of Poole's Diner and other restaurants in Raleigh, North Carolina, and is the author of Poole's, Recipes and Stories from a Modern Diner. Find her recipe for charred squash summer salad at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we're taking your grilling questions with our dear friend, Doc Willoughby, author of the classic Thrill of the Grill. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So we've been talking about grilling all episode long, and now we're going to answer some of your grilling questions. And since I've already said I am only okay at grilling, I'm going to get a little help. This is from my dear friend and mentor, Doc Willoughby. He's the author of the classic cookbook, The Thrill of the Grill, plus many others. And Doc was also my editor, now many years ago, at the dearly departed Gourmet magazine. Hey, Doc, what have you been up to?
Cooking, because like everybody else, we are here. We're in our little cabin in southern Massachusetts, and so you cook every meal, which has been really fun and interesting.
Yeah. I'm glad you say it's interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know, partially I was lucky in that I was doing a cookbook roundup, so I had to cook from a lot of people's cookbooks, which kept me from just cooking my own boring food, so that was fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You have been working on projects to help seniors at this time. What have you been doing?
Well, I'm editing a nonprofit magazine called Seasoned, which is aimed at older adults. And particularly it's aimed at people who either have never really cooked and need to learn to cook, or who need to learn to cook more economically or more healthy food, or cook for fewer people, the kind of situations that older people tend to run into. And right now, I mean, we always have a lot of our subscribers who are, you know, cooking at home a lot, but now everybody's cooking at home all the time. So what we've done to sort of make ourselves more accessible to people is we've started a bi-weekly newsletter, and it has two or three super easy, really delicious, healthy recipes that are mostly made with pantry ingredients because people are not able to go out shopping as much. And then we also have kitchen tricks and exercises for balance, a crossword puzzle or a brain teaser, and then some kind of guide to something like how do you keep produce fresh as long as you can, or when you do go to the supermarket, what's the most efficient way to shop, or how to measure ingredients. So that comes out every other week, and people can subscribe to it by going to Seasoned Mag, all one word, seasonedmag.org. And you don't have to be an older adult. You can be a young person and still use it.
But have you been hearing from your readers, and you know, how have they been getting through?
Well, you know, I think people have problems not just with cooking, but with isolation and, you know, with being unable to get out and shop. But I think we are trying to provide, you know, what we can to make it easier for them to cook. And also, you know, cooking is might be the most essential life skill that there is. And so particularly when you are, a lot of people are alone or with one other person, not with their family. And so being able to cook for yourself, it takes up some of your time. It's kind of entertaining. It can be fun if you can look at it the right way. And
you
make yourself feel more accomplished. It's a real sense of accomplishment, and you know, you feed yourself more healthy food. So I think hopefully during this time people are learning some of these skills that they'll be able to use later. But it's a tough time.
Yeah. And the isolation, I think, has to be
really hard.
Really hard.
I think if, you know, people who are living in apartments and who don't have access to outside space, you know, it's still really hard, but now that the weather is better, if you have any access to outside space, if you have a yard or a park nearby that you can go to, now is the time when you can actually start spending time, you know, properly socially distanced time with other people. And that's really, it's so great.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, and we put out the call for listeners if they have questions about grilling, and sure enough, they just start flowing in. So let's get to some.
Great.
This is Amy from Los Angeles. I'm calling to ask a question about Weber grills. It's kind of not the style I'm used to, so I'm wondering when's the best time to use the lid and when's the best time to leave it off? Thanks for your help. Bye. Mm-hmm.
So this is a great question, one I wonder about a lot. Even if she's not talking specifically about a brand, I think there, you know, gas grills versus charcoal grills, like when do you use the lid and when do you not?
Well, the answer is different for gas grills and charcoal grills. Right. For gas grills, you use the lid a lot because they don't really develop as high heat as charcoal grills. So it helps, you know, things to cook through better if you use the lid a lot. So I have a lot more experience with charcoal grills myself. And there, the general rule of thumb is if you're cooking something like a steak or a single piece of chicken or, you know, sliced eggplant or whatever, something that cooks through quickly, you don't use the lid. You just cook it over the coals. And if you're cooking something large, a whole chicken, a pork butt, whole fish, something like that, then you use the lid. And there is a rule of thumb that if it takes less than half an hour to cook, you shouldn't use the lid. But I think, you know, basically it's easier to say just a smaller piece, you don't use the lid. A larger item, you do. But The other issue is a lot of people like to put the lid down on their kettle grill when they start to get flare-ups or when the food starts to overcook on the outside before it's cooked all the way through. And if you put down the lid or put down the cover, then you're sort of creating an oven effect. And so that does help with those two problems. But an easier way to do it, and I think a better way, is when you build your fire, you build a two-level fire. And all that means is you put all the coals on one side of the grill and leave the other side with no coals at all. So when your food starts to overcook on the outside before it's cooking all the way through, or when you start to get flare-ups, you just move the food to the side that doesn't have any coals. And there's still plenty of heat there, but you're not going to get that direct intense heat. So it'll cook through better, and it also you'll stop the flare-ups. So you can do that instead of putting the cover down, and I think it's probably a better way to do it.
Right on. Yeah, and just to bring back the gas grills for a second, it's like that thing is basically like an oven, right? Like it mostly cooks as if it were an oven.
Yeah, you can get, so on the more powerful ones, you can get, you know, some real direct heat, but nothing like the heat of a charcoal grill. So it really is more like an oven.
Yeah. A lot of your cooking there is going to be lid on.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So let's do another sort of more technical call since we're in this sort of vibe. Let's go to Dan.
Hi, this is Dan from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I usually use charcoal and lighter fluid, but I'm looking into branching out a little bit and potentially using some wood, like a wood fire. I've seen some videos online and I want to try it. So I was wondering if it's at all possible in the first place, or and then what the differences may be as far as taste and things like that, or temperatures, and just want to make sure that I'm doing it right. Thanks.
Dan, you are a brave man.
Yeah.
Wood, of course, is great. I mean, it's the original cooking fuel, obviously, and you do get great flavor from cooking over wood. You have to be attentive. You have to be a person who, I mean, Dan sounds like he's the right person to do it. You have to be a person who wants to be involved with your cooking. You don't want to just like put the food on and walk away, because wood is temperamental. I mean, it's unpredictable. But, you know, it's also fun. And what the secret to cooking with wood really is, you don't want to be cooking over flames. You want to be cooking over coals. So you really need to start about an hour ahead, an hour before you want to cook, because it takes a while for the wood to cook down and have a kind of bed of coals that you want to cook over. Also, you're going to use more wood than you think you will. Because you have a lot of wood and it cooks down to a small amount of coals. So, but it really, it is fun and it's adventuresome and you get great flavor. But if you don't want to be quite as adventuresome as Dan might want to be, one thing that I've done a lot is if you use charcoal and you start your fire and then you get a piece of wood, firewood, and you shove it up against the coals, that will provide you with a lot of wood flavor, and it also burns longer than the charcoal usually. So you get an additional sort of extension of the fire, but it's a lot easier than cooking 100% with wood. But encourage Dan and anybody else who wants to cook 100% with wood to go ahead and do it. What do you have to lose? It's going to be great.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. When you say you want to cook mostly over the coals of the wood rather than flames, why is that?
The coals are actually much hotter than live flames. So that's the heat that you want. Also, the flames are very, it's hard to avoid scorching things with the flames because they reach up high onto the food. So, you know, that's the reason you want to burn it down as much as possible.
Yeah, it's actually weird to think about, right? But it's like, oh, the coals are hotter than the flames, but the flames will burn your food faster.
It is weird, but true.
All right, so speaking of incineration, let's go to Lisa.
Hey, Splendid Table. This is Lisa from Cleveland. I am talking in my quiet voice on the deck so my husband doesn't hear me trashing his grilling skills. So his thing is chicken on the grill, and it always comes out dry and overcooked and with too much barbecue sauce on it. So he needs a new recipe, and he needs a new technique. Is it that he needs to bake it first in the oven and then transfer it to the grill, or does the grill need to have, I don't know, less heat in it? help. Either he needs a new recipe or I need a new husband at this point. So anything you can suggest will be welcome. Thanks so much. Bye.
That's pretty cool, man.
Whoa.
That is stone. That is stone. Well, I got to say, I said speaking of incineration because I was grilling chicken a little while ago and a gas grill and skin on chicken, skin on thighs. I wanted to get a nice crispness on it. I wanted to get a good rendering. So I was, you know, and you know, because they're thick, it takes a while to cook. So and it was a gas grill. So I was covering it with the lid. Went back inside to do some things. Sure enough, I would look outside the window and just billowing smoke. And I go and look, and I totally just absolutely carbonized like the outside of the shit. It was like it was just shiny jet black. It was like stealth fighter black.
Yum.
And I felt completely humiliated. But to Lisa's question, if the chicken is always coming out dry and overcooked, well, actually, let me first get to the suggestion she had. What do you think of the idea of pre-cooking food and finishing on the grill?
Well, I'm not a big fan of it. I mean, you can do it, mm-hmm. and it works, and there's really nothing wrong with it. But, you know, part of the reason you're grilling is to be outside and, you know, playing with fire. So, you know, cooking it in the oven and then taking it outside to sear seems to me a little bit like cheating and not quite as much fun. But this does sound like an emergency situation. So I would recommend in this situation something I don't recommend that much anymore because it's kind of a pain, but that is brining the chicken before cooking it. Because okay. if he's constantly overcooking it, brining will really help with that. And brining just means you take a solution of, you know, 4 to 1 more or less water to salt, and you put the chicken in it for half an hour or up to 2 hours. And what happens is some of the salt and the water gets into the chicken, into the interior of the chicken, sort of plumps up the molecules, and they will not dry out as quickly when it's over the grill. Plus, some of the salt gets in there, so it seasons it, so it actually has better flavor. So in this case, where divorce is imminent, I would recommend, if they have time, that Dan brine his that they brine the chicken before cooking it. And then, if it's a charcoal grill, or even if it's a gas grill, again, I would recommend the two-sided cooking, where you have one side that's mm-hmm. flames, or in the case of charcoal, that's coals, and the other side has none. And the usual method is start out over the coals and then move it over to the other side to finish cooking. But, you know, if he's getting all dry chicken, I would start over the area with no flames or no coals and just cook it till it's almost finished. And then the last 2 or 3 minutes, put it over the side with the coals so you can crisp up the skin.
Oh.
And as for the sauce,
so the reverse way. So you cook
yeah,
it through.
Yeah, that's the reverse of the usual way, but this is all aimed at keeping the chicken from getting dry.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this part too. You said if you're brining chicken, so a lot of people know about brining. So if you already know about brining, the question I have is why maximum 2 hours?
Well, I think that at a certain point, I mean, you can do it longer, but it just you don't get any more effect. So there's really
I see.
Yeah, it's not. I didn't actually mean that. It's, you know, you have to stop after 2 hours, but it's like after 2 hours, you're really not going to get anything more out of it. So
so it's like ready after 2 hours. Oh, right on.
Yeah. So, but you can do it. 15 minutes makes a difference. You know, if you just have 15
really?
Minutes, do it for 15 minutes. And I used to really doubt that, but I have tried it with. I've tried it with. Now this is odd to me, brining fish. But if you brine salmon before you could put it on the grill for 15 minutes, it makes a difference. Same with chicken. So you know, if you have a little bit of time and you don't mind, you know, playing around with the food, the brining really is good for grilled food.
Right on. So Lisa, stick with them. At least for this reason. Maybe it's salvageable.
Don't leave him for the overcooked chicken.
Yeah. All right, Doc. It's always so great to get to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Francis. It's been fun.
Doc Willoughby is pretty much the person who launched my career and is currently the editor of Seasoned, a nonprofit magazine that makes cooking easier for older adults. You can learn more about it at chopchopfamily.org. And that is our show for the week. Please keep sending in your cooking questions, grilling, or otherwise. Just record a voice memo on your phone and email it to contact@splendidtable.org. Thanks for listening. Take care. We'll talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and, you know, you can take our past episodes on your walks or in your car. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we have a great free weekly recipe newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Sign up for it at splendidtable.org. The show is made by these wonderful people, Jenny Lupke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.